Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin Mancini. I am one of your co-hosts here, and I am very happy to welcome my other co-hosts. First, he is the podcast editor for thepopbreak.com, as well as the co-host of the TV Break podcast, Alex Marcus. Hello, Alex.
Hey, Justin. How's it going today?
Oh, it's going pretty well. How about yourself?
Pretty good, pretty good. I'm very excited for the boy band concert that I'm going to later today, so we better keep this quick.
Oh, man. Oh, wow. I mean...
Yes, the well-known band, Five Townships.
And making his presence known, as he often does on this podcast, is...
Sounds so sinister.
He is, along with myself, the co-host of the Podwork Angels The Rush Hour podcast, which you can find on thepopbreak.com, Noah France. Hi, Noah.
Oh, hello.
Good to be back with you as well. It somehow it feels like it's been a while, but that's just a, you know, recording thing. So in terms of our actual release,
what is time?
I haven't seen that way. Exactly. Well, we are very happy to have on this podcast today a very special guest, and she has appeared on our podcast before, but this is the first time she's been on a podcast with Noah and myself, because we were not able to join her on the flashback episode where you and Alex discussed Coming to America. But she is the host of the Live, Laugh, and Lovey podcast, which you can also find on thepopbreak.com, Lovey McPherson. Hello, Lovey.
Good morning, gentlemen. How is everyone?
Good, good. I mean, you know, watching this movie, I think, really improved my mood. So it was, you know, so I feel like I'm doing pretty well, but I'm glad that we got you on for this one. And I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on it.
So what you're saying, Justin, is the movie did not turn you blue. It turned you... not blue.
That's right. Yeah, there were maybe some other movies I've been watching, which we'll get into, that might have turned me blue, but this one. <Uh-oh. not. laughs>
Blue because they were so bad, or blue because they were sad?
Definitely more sad, and
okay,
you know, kind of made me weep for humanity. But anyway,
all right.
Yeah. Real life is tough, guys. History is pretty unforgiving. Anyway.
As a historian, I can confirm.
Yes, and that's why we have you on here.
Justin, something tells me that you've been watching some Oscar movies lately.
Yeah, yes, particularly some documentaries, which, again, we'll get into. But what we typically do on this podcast, we discuss a recent movie release and then sometimes a larger topic related to that release. We may get into some of that later, but we also begin with our full disclosure segment. This is where we talk about recent things we've been watching. And this could be anything from film to television. And we just kind of want to talk about other things we've been watching apart from the main review that we're doing. So to start this out, I thought I'd start with our guest, Lovey. What has been good for you recently?
Oh, gosh, I have so many things under my radar.
I can imagine.
So Bel Air has been my top.
Okay.
And the writing on that is, I love it. It's a totally different spin on the original take of The Fresh Prince of Bel Air. I'm not sure if you guys have been watching it at all.
No, I haven't.
No,
I haven't really heard much about it.
Yeah, I've been hesitant because I grew up in the original Bel Air. That was a big part of my childhood. So anytime something like that gets remade, I'm a little, I don't know.
But it's not really a remake.
Okay.
It's the spin of it all is, how would these characters function in today's society?
Ah, okay. That's interesting.
And it's not comedy. It's more dark.
Okay.
So it's really, really
Where is it streaming?
Peacock.
Okay. I don't know if I have access to that.
Yeah, I don't know if they've launched in Germany yet. Noah is based in Germany, so His streaming world is slightly different from ours.
Okay. So,
but yeah, so what are you liking about the show?
I like it because we can talk about Will, the character Will, and Carlton, and like in the show, if you all remember, Carlton and Will, especially in the beginning, there was a little bit of competition because Will came in and everyone was catering to him and making sure that he was okay and, you know, and basically making him the star. Well, same situation in Bel Air. But in this case, you see the jealousy raging in Carlton, so much so that he suffers from anxiety, which you would think that Carlton in the old series, in the original series, I don't want to say old, in the original series, you could kind of see that based on everything that he has to deal with as far as classism, and he dealt with racism a little bit, but, you know, for the most part, Carlton got along to get along, to fit into that whole lifestyle and community. But Carlton of today, he is snorting Xanax.
Wow.
Yeah. So
there we go.
It's definitely a completely different spin on the original series. But the writing, the cinematography, everything is just, it's great. I cannot tote it enough. It's good. You have to check it out.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know it debuted after the Super Bowl, so it got a lot of big kind of push for its debut, but I really don't know anyone who's watching it, so I haven't really heard much about how it's been progressing. So it's really good to hear that you're liking it after so. How much of it has aired so far?
They're about to wrap. I think this is, it's 10 seasons in the, 10 seasons, geez.
maybe
10,
one day.
Right. 10
episodes. Wow, binge watching culture's really right. Gone over, people.
There are 10 episodes in this season, and they're about to show the final episode this coming week because it airs every Thursday. They drop a new episode every Thursday.
Cool. Right. Also, it's a good time to catch up then.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah, I have to keep reminding myself that not every streaming service does, you know, drops all their episodes at one time, you know, for a season. I kind of like that. I like that all these streaming services have different ways of doing things, and some are kind of, you know, adhering more to the old schedule of how you would typically watch TV, right? Where it was on like at a certain time. But this gives you a little more freedom, but also gives you a little more time to digest each episode. So I like that there's diversity in terms of episode releases.
I think that's kind of a reaction to there was a bit of a pullback. Like, I think a lot of people started to comment on how extreme it was getting when, you know, whole seasons would just drop across multiple platforms. And I think a lot of people did start to say, there was a value to having that anticipation. You know, mm-hmm. you have a good cliffhanger and then you have to wait a week or 2 weeks for the next episode. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I personally like the model where they release 3 episodes at once and then they release weekly after that, because that way you get a good mm-hmm. sense of the show and you can build some momentum and then you can go weekly. But I like Hulu does that and Amazon sometimes does that. But
yeah, I agree. I kind of like the idea of appointment TV. So if you drop mm-hmm. one episode, then great. It leaves me wanting more, because on Netflix, Love is Blind, they did that. They would drop 3 episodes per week, but it just made the season go so fast. So I'm like, I don't like that. Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. But on the other hand, I have a hard time keeping appointments. So.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's what I'm watching. I'm also watching The Gilded Age. I love that. Oh my gosh.
Ooh.
It is amazing. I call it the American Bridgerton.
Yeah, I love The Gilded Age. It's such a silly show that is so fun to watch every week.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And this, of course, as I don't know if Noah is aware, I'm sure that at least I know that you, Alex, are aware, and perhaps you, Lovey, as well, that the creator of the Gilded Age, Julian Fellowes, is probably best known for creating Downton Abbey.
I did not know that.
Yep.
It's just
okay.
I'm glad to hear that this is a good show, because I really feel like that is a show that really went off the deep end. I don't know how deep everybody went into that show, but I definitely jumped off.
Yeah,
that
if,
at a certain point.
if a Ouija board shows up in Gilded Age, run. Just pack your bags, flee the house.
I don't think I got that far.
Right now the Gilded Age is very nicely, like, very low stakes drama every week in a way that's very pleasant. That I really enjoy.
The first season of Downton Abbey was like that too, and it was basically perfect. But then they're like,
it's just like, who's gonna come to the party? Who should sit next to who at the dinner table? Which there was a whole main plot one episode about like how to correctly set the table for a dinner party that was coming. So this is the types of drama that we're in. It's very nice and relaxing, and Carrie Coon is great, and Audra McDonald walks all the way from Brooklyn to Manhattan every week to have the same conversation with her daughter. It's really excellent.
The days when you could walk from Brooklyn to Manhattan easily and back.
It was not easy. She had to take a ferry and then like a walk, or maybe she could get a carriage. It's and like incredible huge dresses. It's insane that she does that every episode.
In those dresses. Okay, that's a chore. Yeah.
Lovey, what are you liking about the show?
It is a silly show, but the acting. I'm a huge Christine Baranski fan.
Yes.
So anything that she's on, I'm so into. But I love her character because she's just like, look, this is old money. Across the street, that's new money. Don't set your sights on that. Stay in your lane.
Yep.
Wow, getting some great Gatsby flashbacks.
And her sister is Cynthia Nixon, and I think she's giving a really excellent performance as this sort of like Daffy but wise spinster character that I really enjoy everything that she does.
Right. Yeah, I'm a big fan of hers as well. Except for Sex and the City. And just like that now, no, I'm not feeling it. I'm sorry, I don't mean to jump.
Season 2's coming.
And you know what? Me and my friend, we were talking about that. It's like, are we watching because we are faithful watchers? Like, we're really enjoying it, or are we watching it out of obligation? And I really feel we're watching it out of obligation.
Yeah, everyone that I know, and I know a lot of people who watch that show, they all seem to watch it because they felt like they had to, and they hated it every week, but they still watched it again.
Exactly.
So why don't you go next, Noah? What have you been watching recently?
I'm going to plug a YouTube channel this time around. One of my sibs got me into Two Set Violin. Have any of you heard of them?
No.
Okay. So they are two very, very chill Australian musicians, like professionally trained. They've played in a bunch of orchestras, musicians of Asian descent. And I have to mention that because they have a lot of jokes in their videos about Asian tiger moms. They have this whole video about Asian mothers talking to each other at recitals, and it's just spittingly funny. So that's a big part of their humor. And they're really just, they're very chill guys. They have a very kind of dry brand of humor, but they're just so much fun. They do videos related to music stuff, like they have a number of videos analyzing musical scenes and movies, and like how accurate is the playing or how accurate is the portrayal of certain composers. They do react to videos to like music fails, or like, you know, TikTok or Instagram videos where like the violin strings break or the piano starts rolling away. It's stuff like that. Or they'll listen to clips of music and they try to guess the movie or the country it's from or something like that. And just a great sense of humor to it. They're just, my wife and I have been watching a bunch of their stuff over the past 2 weeks, and they're an incredibly fun bunch, a couple of guys. So, Two Set Violin. Highly recommend them. And they're fairly, their videos, they're usually somewhere in the 5 to 15 minute range. So you could throw on one or two if you just, you know, you're eating a snack, drinking a coffee, and you just need a quick laugh to, you know, pick up your mood in the middle of the day.
Cool. They have 3.5 million subscribers on YouTube, so they're clearly doing something right.
I just found this out today. I checked out another recent video. They within the past year, actually, they've kind of moved to doing the channel full time now. So they've been doing it as like a passion project for a while, and it picked up steam enough that they can actually support themselves with it. And I always like stories like that. And like I said, they're just chill, fun guys.
How did you get into this? Like, how did you find out about it?
One of my siblings.
Okay.
Sorry, yeah. You know, one of my siblings who's been a fan of them for a while, and they recommended them to me and showed me some of the videos, and I was like, these guys are great. I got to watch more of their stuff.
That's awesome. I mean, I'm glad. I mean, you know, just because I know how many things like your wife introduces to you. So I'm glad that there are other influences in your life as well.
Well, of course. Of course. General rule of thumb, if you want me to get into something on YouTube, talk to family members. If you want, Alex knows this, if you want to get into a TV show, get my wife to start watching it.
Yes.
And eventually I'll start wandering in and be like, oh, you can't watch this unless I'm in the room.
That's generally how it works.
That's how you get it.
Awesome. Let's go to you next, Alex. What's been good for you? I'm sure there's no shortage of things you have to choose from.
That is true, but I'm going to be disciplined this week and only talk about one. And that is a new release this weekend.
I'll start the timer.
A new release this weekend called The Lost City, starring Sandra Bullock, mm-hmm. Channing Tatum, Daniel Radcliffe, and Brad Pitt. This movie, I wasn't planning on seeing it this weekend, but I had a little bit of a gap in my schedule, and it's a nice 90-minute comedy, so it was easy to kind of squeeze in the middle of the day. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. If you don't know what this movie is, it's basically kind of a modern send-up of Romancing the Stone, that Robert Zemeckis movie from the 80s with Michael Douglas and Catherine Turner. That's a movie that I actually only saw for the first time last year, and I really loved it. I thought it was really fun. Yeah, I know Lovey's giving me a face like, how could you have only just seen it? But I know. But I'm glad that I did. I'll watch it a number of times in the future because it's a really fun movie. It's funny. It's exciting. It's sexy. It's got a great Danny DeVito performance in the middle of it. This movie, unfortunately, kept reminding me of Romancing the Stone, which was probably a bad thing because it's hard to be as good as Romancing the Stone. But for what it is, it was a lot of fun. You know, it was probably about like 20% not as good as it could have been, given how talented Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum are as an on-screen duo, right? Tatum is in his full kind of like 21 Jump Street mode of being a delightful himbo who like has a heart of gold but is kind of a dummy, and Sandra Bullock is really kind of going all out as both a very smart and competent person but also just having great fun with opportunities for physical comedy. Like there's an early scene where she has to sit on a stool in front of a group of people while wearing a very very close like tight one piece jumpsuit, and she just makes such an incredible meal out of it. It's like a solid 2 minutes of her just getting onto the stool. It's very funny.
I like that analogy.
Yeah, it's so she's really great. They're supposed to like fall in love at some point in this movie, and I never really felt like they did, which kind of hurts it as a kind of rom-com, right? That you kind of need to buy into the romance there, and they just didn't really feel like they had any chemistry together. And that's especially bad considering that Romancing the Stone, there's so much heat between Michael Douglas and Catherine Turner in that movie. So that is kind of lacking, but it is really funny throughout. Daniel Radcliffe plays this kind of like maniacal billionaire who's out for some famous crown that is buried in South America somewhere that he needs Sandra Bullock's help to find.
Okay, Alex, stop. You had me at Daniel Radcliffe plays a crazed billionaire. I'm sold.
He's really funny. He's as we know by now, is not afraid to be the butt of the joke, and he gets to be very often here.
I can pretty much only stand like all of his post Harry Potter career choices. They've just been amazing.
Yeah, he's really great. The central plot is basically like Sandra Bullock plays this woman who is a successful romance writer. She writes these kind of adventure romance novels, Channing Tatum is her cover model, who she sees from time to time during publicity for the book, but kind of resents because she wishes that she was a more serious academic writer. She has a background in like actual anthropology and kind of swerved into romance novels because the book she wanted to write couldn't get funded. And then all of a sudden she has a 20-year career in it. So there's a lot of resentment that she's kind of projecting on him. And she's also dealing with grief of her husband, who was an anthropologist, who recently in the last year or two passed away. And so she's kind of like trying to get out from underneath that and kind of reflecting on her life and is not very satisfied. And then suddenly Daniel Radcliffe is this billionaire who kidnaps her because he realizes that the information in her most recent book actually relates to this crown that he wants to find, and he believes that she is the only person who can help translate the materials in order to solve it, and she is not interested in doing it, and so he kidnaps her, and it kind of goes from there. And Divine Joy Randolph is in this as kind of like the book publisher, like agent or whatever. It's kind of nebulous what she actually is beyond like Sandra Bullock's professional friend, but she's really funny throughout. She kind of has not a lot of great stuff to do that she really makes the most out of. She's kind of the person that they keep cutting back to while the adventure is going on. So it's always like the less interesting stuff, but she really sells it in both the comedy and the drama of it in a way that really makes it a lot of fun. And also, I know someone that Justin really likes, Patty Harrison, is in it as Divine Joy Randolph's intern, basically, who is managing Sandra Bullock's social media account while she is kidnapped. And that she has a lot of fun with that role as sentence. Well.
It's a lot of fun. I have to say this movie has been confusing because it's called The Lost City, and we've just fairly recently had The Lost City of Z.
So, yeah.
I'll pass over an article mentioning that and be like, why is there a picture of Sandra Bullock? She wasn't in The Lost City of Z. Oh.
So I think that's kind of intentional. It was actually for a very long time called The Lost City of D, which is also the name of the book in the movie, the book that she wrote.
That would have messed me up even more.
And it's like and it's like a great joke in the movie because she says like, oh, like the D stands for this like ancient tribe that has a difficult name to pronounce. And I wanted to put it that as the name, but the book publisher wouldn't let me. So we shortened it just to The Lost City of D. And of course, she writes these kind of lurid romance novels. So it's supposed to be sort of like a pun. Right. But and so it's a great kind of send up. And we have recently had this movie called The Lost City of Z. Right. I think they made the right call of just calling it The Lost City for everyone else, like as an actual
otherwise,
film.
Otherwise, we'd
have
had to have 26 part movie series: Lost City of A, Lost City of B, Lost City of C.
Well, and also I think just, you know, Channing Tatum in a movie called The Lost City of D might have different expectations for what we end up getting. You know, they might think it's
sorry,
like
that's,
a secret
that's
Magic
the subtitle,
Mike spinoff.
That's the subtitle for Magic Mike 3: The Lost City of D.
Yeah. So I think it was the right call, but it's a good joke in the movie itself. But yeah
whoever
it's...
produces the Magic Mike movies, my PayPal's open. You want to take my idea? Just pay me accordingly.
And it's also like Brad Pitt is in this movie as it's kind of more of an extended cameo than anything else. But he's basically like the cool, rugged person that Channing Tatum can't live up to. And I think that's really excellent casting as
Brad
kind
Pitt.
Of one heartthrob to another from the earlier generation. So it's a really fun movie. I think that if you go, you'll enjoy it. You'll have a laugh. I don't think you need to see it in theaters. It's a Paramount movie. I'm pretty sure it'll be on Paramount Plus in 6 weeks. And if you want to wait and watch it at home with a bottle of wine, I think you'd have a lot of fun doing that as well.
Alex, how can you say that? You're killing movie theaters.
Well... Listen, I mean, this is a movie, you know, I would love this movie to get the type of success that Spider-Man No Way Home got, but I don't think that that's, you know, it's a movie that's marketed towards, you know, women between the age of 25 and 45, and I think that that's excellent, and I love everything that's marketed in that demographic, personally, but unfortunately, those aren't the movies that are blowing out the box office anyway. So I think it's okay to just watch it on Paramount Plus if you need to.
I mean, it sounds like it may be a nice alternative of something like Uncharted, which does not sound like anything I'm interested in, just based
on... Yeah, although, you know, I haven't seen that movie, but people said that it's better than they expected, which, you know, is faint praise for sure, but...
Yeah. All right. Okay, so I apologize because I'm about to take things down a little bit with the thing that I've been watching, which I would still recommend, but the subject matter is you have... Like, definitely know what you're getting into. I feel like I've said that so many times on this podcast.
It's the subtitle of our podcast.
It should be at this point. but I'm going to recommend the documentary, which is actually, I've been watching a lot of Oscar-nominated stuff. And let me tell you, it really does run the gamut in terms of quality. You have some of my favorite films of the year, along with some of the most mediocre. But something
what year is that not the case?
True. True. And so something I did see recently that I would definitely recommend, it's up for best documentary, is a film called Attica. And as the title suggests, this is a documentary about the Attica uprising in the early 70s in New York State. For me, it was definitely an education. I knew very little about what happened and like not just the details, but the progression of events. That was like the big surprise to me. I mostly knew it as like, isn't that a line from Dog Day Afternoon that like Al Pacino screams and may or may not have anything to do with what he's doing in that film? But this was a real life event in which prisoners of this like pretty like maximum security prison took over the prison, or not even necessarily the prison, the whole complex, but a significant part of it. And actually took hostages and were attempting to negotiate demands for their treatment in prison. They were being like not beyond, you know, just look, you know, just looked down upon, like they were being actively abused, physically or otherwise, just really awful things. And they were basically saying, hey, we're just asking for like decent human, like we are human beings. Is it too much to ask for us to be treated that way? And apparently it was. And the film really unfolds in, I think, very skillfully made, because you almost feel like you're watching things in real time. And this is done through archival footage. They actually interview people today who were prisoners or even like the families of some of the hostages. The directors here are Tracy Curry and Stanley Nelson. Nelson, I know, has done another documentary I'd recommend, which was Black Panther's Vanguard of the Revolution, which was also a history lesson for me from a few, I guess, a couple, like maybe like 5 or 6 years ago now. And I just think they have such a facility with telling this story, which is very tough, especially once the... there is a mounted attack from police officers, but especially the state police, the New York State Police, where they essentially take back, you know, this this courtyard that the prisoners are holding. And the description of it, the footage that we see is disturbing, to say the least. At a certain point, you just get a sense that there is no It just kind of reinforces the fact that these prisoners were not seen as human beings. And that is really tough. Like you get very vivid descriptions, and I feel like Nelson and Curry are working with a lot of different elements to give you and giving you a lot of different angles into this story. And there's especially that stuff. And they're like, even just like photographs that they have. I don't want to get into it, but let's just say it is, you know, basically the worst thing that human beings can do to one another. And the real outrage is that it was all kind of legally sanctioned. There were no consequences for any of the people involved. So, yeah, it's a tough movie. I feel like it's a necessary movie. It's one that I would encourage everybody to see. Regardless of your politics, because I don't think this film presents all this information. I don't think it makes heroes or villains of people. It presents all this information as what happened, You know, in the, you know, as much as you can when you're still telling the story, there's always going to be a perspective. But I think they present it as objectively as they can and try to give voice to everybody, whether they were people actually involved or people looking back on it now. So yeah, this is a it's a tough movie. It's really skillfully made. And I'm glad that it's getting attention because it's such a necessary history lesson. And unfortunately, I'm not sure what we've learned from it since then, but it's but I hope that maybe it can affect some real change in this world, because I think it has that potential anyway.
Yeah, well, I've seen this film as well. And I also want to echo everything that you said. I thought I knew about the Attica prison riot, and I didn't, based on watching this film. Because what I knew about was, like, the prisoners taking the prison and, like, it being this kind of really important movement. Like, it's happening in 1971, so it's right around, you know, the cresting of the civil rights movement and all of this other stuff that's going on in the culture. And it was kind of this moment of, you know, people taking, trying to take control of their treatment and demanding respect in a way that many people in many different groups during that time were. And that's how I understood it. And I understood that eventually it was crushed, you know, and that they were not ultimately successful, but I had no idea to the extent that they were crushed and to the horrific treatment of the prisoners afterwards, nor did I really understand the full context of why that prison riot happened in the first place. As you said, it wasn't, you know, the way that we treat prisoners in America now and always has never been particularly respectful. And that has been an area where a lot of activists have been trying forever to get movement. But I didn't realize the extent to which this was a particularly horrific case in the first place. And just the generational trauma of that institution in upstate New York and just what came of it was really, really awful. And I think that what the filmmakers do that are so great, this was a highly, highly publicized event as it was happening. Tons of news reports, tons of actual like cameras in the prison, outside the prison. So, and they take advantage of all of that archival footage and really let the prisoners, both in interview and in archival footage, tell the story of what's happening. And, you know, and also, you know, talk to the family of the hostages and explain how horrifying that experience was as well for them, especially the people who were children at the time, which you could imagine being very traumatic. And it really, the filmmakers let you really see these prisoners for fully three-dimensional people with so much promise and potential and complexity and nuance. And then that maximizes the impact of what ends up happening to them in the last act of the documentary, to the point that, I mean, it would be disturbing regardless, but it's doubly disturbing given how well we've gotten to know these people. And also, by the time that it happens, there is this sense of inevitability where it seemed like it was there was no other way that this situation could have resolved. So that kind of creeping fatalism to the documentary also amplifies the emotional impact of it. But yeah, I think just in terms of, you know, making change in the future, I think that's great. But it's also just feels like a lost piece of history that people just don't know. And I think it's important for people to know their history. And so I think that it's great that this exists. It's streaming on Showtime, so anybody with a Showtime subscription can watch it, which I think is good. And I hope one day this becomes widely available so more people can see what happened there and give the sacrifices that these people made a little bit more respect, at the very least.
So Turning Red, this is the newest Pixar movie from Domi Shih, who of course actually was a name I recognized because I was like, oh, she was the director of Bao, the short film that actually won an Oscar from, I guess, maybe 5 years ago or so at this point. I remember seeing it in the theater before a Pixar movie, and I can't remember which film it was. I mean,
it was 2018, so it was in front of probably the Incredibles 2.
Ah, okay.
Oh, okay, that makes sense. Yes, I'm remembering that now. But yes, this is her new film, Turning Red, is about a young girl
first
growing
feature
up.
Film, right? If I recall, yes. If I heard correctly.
Yeah. Yes. She's worked on other films, but this is her first as like the director, the one really running the show. Mm. And this, of course, concerns a young girl in 2002 Toronto. Love the specificity of this. Maylin Lee, who is going through some changes, as one typically does around the age of 13 or so. this is, let's just say she learns about a certain mystical connection she has with her family, which may or may not be voluntary. And I think that's interesting that the film sort of explores that. But yeah, Turning Red, guys, what did we think? Maybe I'll start I want to start with our guest, Lovey. What did you think of the movie?
Oh, it was so cute. It was really cute. And I really loved that. This was a feature film emphasizing the Asian culture. I could really appreciate that because I think the other feature film that featured Asian culture was what, Mulan?
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
if we're talking American animated films. Yeah.
Yeah. We also had Raya the Last Dragon last year.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So I could definitely appreciate that. But it was really cute. And yeah, it took me back to the early 2000s where they had the little electronic
Tamagotchis.
I was never one that carried one of those, but I used to see my nieces and nephews carry that. So yeah,
I actually never had one either. That completely passed me by. But
but yeah, it was really cute. The graphics alone is what got me, and with fabulous 8K TV, I saw everything. I was like, oh, this is awesome. But yeah, it was really cute, and I thought it was well written. It was easy. I feel like it was easy to understand both as an adult as well as a child. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
I notice you're wearing a red shirt today. Is that in solidarity with the film?
No, this was just the easiest to throw on. But we can go with that. We can go with that.
Yeah, no, there's a great energy to the animation style. It's one of those... I get frustrated with especially a lot of American CGI animation, because it starts to feel, even some of the not as great Pixar movies start to feel a little bit samey at some point. They don't really stand out visually. But this one, you can see the anime influences in a lot of the character expressions, a lot of the reaction shots, and in a lot of the movements too. And I really appreciate that. It's a great crossover feel.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the animation in this film. It really it balances that kind of tactile Pixar, we can make this feel super hyper real, and the sort of expressiveness that animation can have that can really amplify an emotion, which I think this film is all about, amplified emotions. Mm. So I'm glad that they took that stylistic diversion a little bit, because it really kind of pays off, especially for our lead character.
Yeah. Well, all the friends in the group have really, they all look and act and move distinctly from each other. Mm-hmm, and that's a great balancing act that, you know, a lot of movies, like the one best friend in air quotes will stand out a bit more, and the others might blend together. But they're all very distinct, like all four members of this little group. by the way, for me personally, Abby is my new ride or die. So I'm Team Abby.
So Justin, what did you think about the movie?
I really loved it. I was a little bit more so than I usually am for a Pixar movie. I wasn't sure if this was going to be my thing. I remember seeing the trailer, and there's a point, and they say it in the movie too, but in the trailer, where she's kind of talking about her life and she's like, yeah, it's a lot. And I'm thinking like, yes, that is exactly the vibe I'm getting. Might be too much for me. I don't know. But I really think actually watching the movie, all of that, there is a kind of, I wouldn't say it's constant, but there is a sort of manic energy to some parts of the movie. And seeing it in context with the point in her life that this young woman is at, like, it made sense. Like, it had a purpose. So I think that was what, that's why I was able to connect with it. And also, like, I'll just say, not having this person's, you know, this character's upbringing, I had very different parents from hers. You know, I had different friends. I had maybe different interests at that point in my life, but I was surprised how much I was thinking about things I haven't thought about since I was that age, which is a real testament to the movie that it has that power. We'll get into maybe some of the more specifics, but that was the reason why I think it connected with me on a deeper level than I really expected it to. And I agree with you, Noah, about the animation style. I think it's a very eclectic animation style. It feels, I know that Domi Shi has talked about how anime was a big influence for her here. There's one shot, which I'm fairly certain is a visual reference to The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, the Mamoru Hosoda film, which I was like, not expecting at all. I took a screenshot of it, and just to look at it versus the famous poster, which is also in the film, I'm like, this person has some good taste in movies and in media in general.
We forgot to mention, guys, you know what this reminds me of to a certain extent? Over the Moon. How many of you guys saw that?
I've seen it, and I don't like that film nearly as much as I like this.
It's was that a Disney movie? I'm actually blanking.
No, I forget.
Was that Sky Blue?
No, I don't think so. It was. I'd have to look. Okay. But I don't think it was any sort of major.
Think thematically it's very similar. It's about about family relations and like the legacies of your parents. I do agree with you. This is the better version of that. But there were some aspects of Over the Moon that I did appreciate. Not the rapping scene. That was a travesty. And that's the last time we'll mention that in this show.
Yeah, Over the Moon is a Netflix original film. It was produced by Pearl Studio, and it was directed by Glenn Keane, who got his start doing a lot of the classic Disney Renaissance films.
But,
I believe this is his first actual directing effort back in 2020.
Okay.
But yeah, big fan of this. Didn't expect it to move me as much as it did. And, you know, just, I don't know, if you've been this age, I'm surprised that anyone couldn't find something to relate to, you know, that infamous review notwithstanding, which I don't know if I want to get into at certain point.
We don't need to get into it. I love the specificity of the story, because I agree, it really does help capture that moment where you are just like, you are no longer a child, but your family hasn't caught up to that fact yet, right? And you are very much not an adult. You don't have any sense of the world, but you have a sense of yourself that no one outside of you and maybe your friends really understands yet. And that's a very precarious place to be in the world. And I think this movie does such a great job expressing that. And I think Rosalie Chang, who is Mei Lin, that's our main character, I think she's really great. I think Sandra Oh as her mom, I mean, I'm never going to say a bad word about Sandra Oh on this podcast. She's so excellent. I mean, I would watch an entire second movie just about her life. I just wanted more of Sandra Oh any chance I got.
Oh, man. Yeah. Yeah.
But I also love that in this relationship, like, we've seen the sort of, like, overbearing mother and, you know, insecure daughter who then becomes a rebellious daughter. We've seen that a million times. But what this story does is, like, it shows that Mei Lin really likes her mom and respects her mom and wants her mom's approval, but also wants her mom's companionship, right? This is a person who's really important to her. But she is not who her mom thinks she is, right? She feels like she has to keep closing off more and more of who she is as she explores new parts of herself, because her mom has this vision of her that she's afraid to break, right? And I think that there's a lot more nuance there than what we're used to in these sorts of stories. And I really respected that a lot.
And that makes them much more real and, dare I say it, relatable. Because, yeah, you know, that's the dynamics in most families. You get to that point where the parents haven't quite realized how far the kid is. The kid thinks that they're more adult and more grown up than they actually are, because Madeline is not an adult.
Yeah.
Her protestations to the contrary, she is not grown up, not by a long shot, and neither are her friends. The movie makes that very clear. But that is, you know, that's a time period of at least potential conflict. It doesn't have to escalate. And of course, you know, most families don't result in, like, you know, a kaiju style boy band battle over the skies of any major city, much less Tokyo.
I mean, we all remember when you and your dad blew up the Houston Astrodome in your younger years.
No, that wasn't my younger years. That was,
I think it was Turner Field, wasn't it, Noah?
No. And it wasn't my kid. It was last year in November when we blew up the Astrodome.
Oh, wow. Okay.
This baseball is all news reference. To me.
Lovey's like, what the heck happened?
No, I'm following.
Okay. No, I'm making a World Series reference last year because I'm still over the moon about that. Aha. Bring it full circle.
Okay, well, we're going to cut Noah's mic now. Lovey, what did you think about this relationship between the mom and daughter in this film?
No, I totally agree. I do feel that she does respect her mom, and she does, in fact, appreciate the friendship that they do have. But there is another side of her where she is wanting to hang with her friends, which, by the way, the friends were giving me life, especially the one that was speaking in such a monotone. Yeah.
Oh, Priya.
Priya, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. I see myself in each of them because I am that friend that's almost like, yes! Oh, my God! So, definitely. But she just wants to be able to have fun. But it's all, to me, I got that she's just trying to find a balance. And trying to have her mom understand that there's a balance. Hey, yes, I can be by your side. I can attend to the temple. But I also want to be able to kick it with my friends at the concert and go to the concert without an attended parent. I didn't understand that. I was like, so these 13-year-olds are going to a concert?
By themselves. Yeah, that's
a major concert alone. Okay. Yeah, so, but yeah, I really, 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 really liked, and then I grew up with friends whose parents were like that, and so I could definitely relate to that. It's just like, oh yeah, I remember having friends that had to go home. Oh, I have to go home because I have to do this, and my mom needs me to do that, so yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very relatable for me as well, as a person who may or may not have had a bit of an overbearing mother at times. I can relate to that tension of, like, wanting to be the perfect person, but wanting to have your own life and having a hard time, you know, as a kid trying to balance those things. And yeah, I just really want to say again that I love the fact that they didn't resort to cliches in this. They didn't, like, it didn't become, oh, I hate you, mom, you're terrible. Like, it never goes into that. And it's never like, oh, she's a teenager and now she's a totally uncontrollable monster. Like, you would think that's what the movie's going for because she literally turns into a monster. But it doesn't. It's like, she's not a monster. She's an adorable panda that everybody likes, which is, like, really nice. And I think it just takes this thing that's existed in our culture for so long, the kind of, like, oh, once your daughter turns 13, she's going to become terrible and it's going to be 10 years of screaming and fighting and crying and you're going to hate her and she's going to hate you and then you're going to end up on the other side of it better off, right? That's what I've heard so many people tell, like, parents of girls this. And it's a really toxic thing to tell people. And I love that this movie just brings a lot more humanity and empathy and nuance to that story.
Yeah. And one of the keys, I think, with the whole, like, with the transformations, is that, and this distinguishes it, I think, from other, honestly, even other Pixar movies that deal with animal, you know, transformations, is that there's still like you still retain a level of you still are yourself. You're just in this new form. You can still speak. I mean, I love the fact that that giant kaiju battle that you mentioned, Noah, at the end when her mom is this, you know, gigantic, you know, kaiju level panda is like she's still saying things like, how could you do the like she's still saying the exact kind of complaints that she would, you know, in her regular human form.
Yeah, just the big booming voice.
And I think by doing that, it's giving this level of agency to these characters that this is who they are. Like, this isn't just some, you know, manifestation of themselves where they've lost control. Like, they are very much in control and are still themselves. It's just another way of expressing it. And that, I think, distinguishes it from other movies that that use this trope. And I guess, like, you know, while she is this adorable panda, the fact that there's this backstory of, like, you know, this was her ancestors were warriors and would use this form like in battle. And you can see that. Yeah. Like, there's a point where it gets pretty terrifying where when she gets angry, she's no longer that adorable. She's still in panda form, but she's no longer adorable. She is like going to do some serious damage.
We've all had those moments where we felt like that. You feel like you're about to turn into a giant rage monster. And, you know, those moments where you would be capable of, like, wrecking someone's shit if you could magically turn into a giant beast monster. So it's one of those ways in which animation or this type of film can literalize what something can feel like. Something that you usually can't really describe or portray visually, but you can in this method by using this crazy metaphor, you know, with turning into a red panda being a you know, multifaceted metaphor for growing up, hitting puberty, getting your first period. Love that scene with the mother where the mother thinks it's the period and is going on all these, she's like, oh, no, mom, what are you talking about? Like,
and then she goes to school and waves the box of pads in the window. Oh my God. That's if that ever happened in my middle school, that would be all anyone talked about for like a month.
Yeah. I mean, I think the film does such a good job of normalizing the panda. Like, that, again, not something I knew going into this that was going to be a thing. But, like, I love the ease with which her classmates accept it as a part of her. Like, think about how many movies where someone transforms into a thing and everybody's just, like, screaming and running away in terror, right? And this film is just kind of like, there's a little bit of that. But at a certain point, just, like, it's just a part of who she is. And it's really cool. And it's like, if this happened, it probably would be. Like, so I just think it does a good job of normalizing.
I'd be down with it if one
which is, you know, in line with the film's themes.
I'd be down with it if one of my friends suddenly turned into a giant panda. Alex, get on that.
Yeah, I'm gonna take a pass on that one. Lovey, how do you feel? Would you want to turn into a giant panda to please your friends?
If I could capitalize on a year like they did.
Nice.
Yeah, absolutely. Very fair. And I guess one thing that I guess I can relate to is how I see it, because I'm in a wheelchair. So May turning into the panda, I kind of correlated as like, yes, she has something differently unique about her. Mm-hmm. And having her classmates and her friends accept her as who she is, I could definitely relate to that, because growing up, I grew up with my disability, and I accepted my disability, which when you're comfortable with yourself, with whatever inflictions that you may deal with, it makes it easier for others to be more comfortable with it. And so I could kind of see that within myself. With this character. So yeah, I was like, you know what, yeah, if she want to be a panda, she can be a panda. And everyone loved it, as everyone loves me. So
yes, of course, you are loving. What's not to love? But yeah, no, I think that that's a really good point. And I think that a lot of the stuff that we deal with as people, but especially at that age of our life, when it's new and scary to us, we assume that it's going to be scary to other people, and that they'll like make us pay for it in some way. And in fact, most of the time, you are your biggest critic. You are the person that you are most that are going to be the hardest on as opposed to other people. And yeah, in my experience as well, like when I actually, to be candid, when I was pretty close to May Lynn's age, was in a wheelchair also for about a year. And that was a very difficult time in my life. But what I found was that everyone, all the kids, not they didn't make fun of me. They thought, oh, that's so cool. You're in a wheelchair. That's awesome. And they wanted to take turns pushing me around and things like that. And it was this fun kind of exciting novelty, right? Because they weren't the ones experiencing it. So it was just, this is a cool thing that's happening. And that's exactly how this film treats the panda issue, right? Because kids are just like, they want to see something new and cool and interesting. And you're going to turn into a fluffy red panda? That's cool. Can I take a picture with you? You know, like that's very true. Whereas like the, you know, when Maylin first experiences this, she's horrified by the change, and her parents are very much like, we can't let anyone see this. We need to protect you. We need to protect you. And it's like, that is actually way more toxic than the world sometimes is to you. So yeah, I think that's a really good point.
Yeah. I also just, I love the moment when she realizes that her friends are this calming influence on her. And even before she ends up talking to her parents and basically lying to them about the fact that they are that calming influence, I was like, oh, they're going to, like, the implication here is that her parents are very much not that. At least not in this case. And that was, you know, I thought that was pretty, I was like, wow, that's pretty, to show that in a movie that's aimed at families, that's pretty daring. But also, like, it, again, for this particular character, it's very true in that moment. And I think there are all kinds of those moments strewn throughout this movie. So it was really nice to, it was nice to see that. There's a real honesty here. And sometimes that is, it makes things uncomfortable, right? The truth can be uncomfortable, even if it's true. And I feel like this film doesn't shy away from any of that. And just, again, that's part of what, that's what makes it special. That's what makes it relatable. But ultimately there is, I think the way this film actually resolves the relationship between the mother and daughter is really effective, because in a way it's not fully resolved. It's very much like they have kind of accepted that they are different people. It doesn't mean they love each other less, but they're not who they were at the start of this movie. And I think that's a more realistic depiction of what, you know, relationships with not just parents and children, but, you know, between generations can be like. You have to accept a certain level of distinction and change, you know, throughout your lives.
One thing that I wanted to talk about also is just the way in which generations plays into this, right? The way that the, you know, we have all of this set up between Maylin and her mom, and we have this whole context for it that we think we understand. And then all of a sudden we get this phone call from Maylin's grandmother, her mom's mom, played by Wei Ching Ho, who's just excellent in everything. And you suddenly get a complete deepening and enrichment understanding of this family dynamic, right? It just shifts things to the point where it's like, oh, right, her mom also exists in a mother-daughter relationship that is complicated and messy and might actually be informing everything that we've been seeing, right? And it's, and they do it in a really funny way where she's like, where Sandra Oh's character is saying like, oh, I just can't believe that she would do this to her mother and be so disrespectful. And then like her mom calls and she's immediately like the kid
doing this. I'm not here.
Really the diving same way. Out of the frame.
but that's like humorously capturing something that's really real, right? Where like you internalize the dynamic that you've inherited from your parent and sometimes lose track of the feeling of being the kid in that dynamic instead of just kind of internalizing the mother role that you've been kind of pushed into by expectations from your own mother that you resented in the moment. So it's really, it makes it a lot more complicated. And I think that kind of the generational impact of things really adds to this. I think it would be much less if it was just about one mother and one daughter instead of this entire kind of matriarchy of relationships and of kind of culture and family and all of the good and all of the bad that comes with it. Because again, the grandmother is not like this monster figure. She's not this like terrible, cruel, disciplinarian or anything. She's coming to her granddaughter's aid, who she loves very much, and she's bringing all of her sisters to help, and she wants what's best for her as well, just like she wants what's best for her mom. Mm. But she can't see who Mei Lin is any more than she can see who Ming is, Mei Lin's mom. And that is kind of what makes Sandra Oh's character, I think, so interesting, because it lets her make a different choice.
Yeah.
In a different way from what the different choice that Mei Lin makes. Because you kind of think, oh, well, maybe what's going to happen is Sandra Oh's character is going to learn from her daughter that she should embrace the panda too. It's like, no, that's not what they're saying. They're saying that they need to respect each other and each other's choices and understand each other's perspectives better. And I think that's actually way more valid, because it's a little bit, I think it's an easier choice for a screenplay to make, to say like, well, the mom and daughter learn from each other, and now they both realize that they'd be better off as pandas. But that's not real. Like a grown woman isn't going to completely change her understanding of who she is as a person because of the identity crisis that her daughter is having, right? So I think that treating it this way is a lot more interesting and a lot more true to life as well.
Yeah, I think it's very poignant that the mother and the aunties and the grandmother, they all very much decide, okay, we had to let the panda out to deal with the situation, and now we're going to put that back into the bottle. It's not we're not going to be a family of pandas jumping around, you know, the Toronto cityscape, which is
as
how
much as like, I'd love to have seen that.
Well, I mean, a different version of this movie would end like that, but it is very clear that they're like, okay, we're all going to put this back in the bottle now. We're not going to force me to do it, but we're definitely going to go back to we're going back to our status quo. And again, that's just, it's a little choice. It doesn't seem like a big choice, but it makes it much more true to real life, I think. Also, I have to say, love the introductory sequence for the aunties. They come in and line up with all four of the different boot styles. Yeah. It's like
and it's all the pinching. That feels like a reference to a very American. Like, it's pinching, and it's you're too thin and you're too heavy at the same time, right? Like, you're eating too much, you're not eating enough. I liked all of that a lot. And I liked the way that her character,
I'm a sucker for those stereotypical family moments, like, oh God, the aunties are here.
But also what I liked about it was, like, Mei Lin, in that moment, is really feeling the most like an independent teenager as she has. And then they come in, and she just immediately regresses to a kid, because she's just like overpowered by how they see her and just can't even attempt to fight back. Right. And so she just immediately feels like a child again in that sequence. And I think that that's really making a subtle point about family in an interesting way, and about Mei Lin as a character specifically, too.
Yeah. Another thing I really want to comment on, one of the moments that I found especially interesting in the movie and how it deals with especially the intergenerational experience of immigrants, of families who are a minority in a different country that's not, you know, of their, you know, where their family is originally from. This line where the mother says, you know, they talk about how the red panda, there's the symbolism for it, you know, in certain parts of Chinese culture. And there are certain, you know, traditional beliefs about, you know, red panda. And that's what led to their ancestor making this decision to, you know, or making this connection with, you know, the mystical red panda to like be a force for good, or like a force for defending the family. And then she says, and then we left and came to a new place where something that back then in, you know, China had this positive meaning, here it's inconvenient. And it's the way she it's not that it became dangerous or it became a power too great to control or something like that. It was inconvenient. Like, from the home country, it meant something good there, but here no one really understands it, so best just bottle that away and pretend it doesn't exist. That is, like, I mean, they're specifically doing this within the context of, like, Chinese-Canadian, or you could do the same if you could do either Chinese-Canadian or Chinese-American, but you can apply that to pretty much any immigrant experience where some aspect of your family's older traditions or beliefs or cultural practices, you feel like you have to kind of hide that because, oh, the people here, they're not going to get it. They're going to think we're weird. They're going to think we're creepy or scary, or just they'll make fun of us, you know? And just like again, a little choice like that, like not saying, oh, it became dangerous, but you're using the word inconvenient. That feels, it's such a specific word with such a specific connotation. That moment really hit for me. I was like, ooh, that was a, that's a, that's good screenwriting.
Yeah, you know? It's a surprisingly rich text. It definitely is.
And sorry, just really quick, I just wanted to mention that this was co-written by the director, Domi Shi, but also was co-written by Julia Cho, who's a very accomplished playwright. So I think there's a level, just the fact that you're getting into the nuance of the language, like, makes sense, given the creators, like, I think there is that level of attention and detail paid to it as a result.
Yeah, and there's actually a whole hour-long special on Disney Plus right now about the making of this film, and it really goes into depth on all of the choices that they made and all of the women that were at the center of this film. And it's really great. It's a very interesting and enriching experience.
I didn't know that. I missed that. I'm gonna have to go back and watch.
Yeah, it should be like right there on the Disney Plus homepage, because they've been kind of pushing it. So yeah, you should definitely check it out. It's really great. But something I want to ask you, Noah, is, you know, you are a big score guy for movies, and this film was scored by Ludwig Göransson, who of course did the Black Panther score and the Mandalorian score that got so much attention. And I'm curious what you thought about the music in this film, both the score and then of course the great pop songs that were produced by Billie Eilish and Phineas, as a matter of fact.
Oh, the pop songs work. I think they work well within the context of the movie. You know, it's not, in a boy band music is not like my kind of music per se. And I know they're making something of a comeback these days, you know, especially via like Korean boy bands. But no, like it's like they're good, catchy songs. They work within the context of the movie. I like the fact that they're songs where at first it's like, oh, this is just a catchy pop song that the girls are into. But there's a thematic resonance as well. Like it ends up tying into a lot of the themes about, you know, personhood that the movie's trying to get at. The score is great. I think the score for the Batman is my favorite of the year. It's going to be hard to top that, but I'm going to wait until a few more movies come out, and then I'll start trying.
Well, sure. We're only a quarter of the way through the year, so you don't need to declare your favorite score yet.
But work, you know.
But Lovey, do you like me share a profound love and affection for boy bands?
Yes. Oh my gosh, I was the biggest NSYNC fan.
Sure, yeah, of course. See, I grew up with an older sister, so like she was prime teenage year, like age in the years of this film, like between, like she was in high school from like 1999 to you know, like that area. So it's, I knew all of the boy band music because that's the only music we could listen to in the car, you know, 98 Degrees, NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, you know, all of that stuff. So O-Town, of course, I remember she played that one O-Town song for like literally on a loop every night for weeks for like hours at a time until I wanted to like scratch my ears out. So I've been kind of indoctrinated into the cult of boy band for sure, especially this era of boy bands.
Yes, and then my favorite boy band of all time is New Edition, which they do not get the credit that they deserve. Because this group is probably one of the last remaining groups that is still touring to this day. So
they toured with Backstreet Boys not too long ago, right?
I do believe so. Yes.
Yeah, but they were there before any of them. Mm-hmm. They were like early 90s, like new kids on 70s. The block.
They started.
They weren't
in
just new edition. They were the newest of editions.
Okay. Wow. I didn't realize they were that old. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So, yes, I am a big fan of boy bands. Yes.
How did the music hold up for you? Do you think that Billie Eilish and her brother did a good job capturing that sound?
I was Shazamming it as I was watching it. Yeah, I was like, okay, this is catchy. All right. I like it. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It, like you said, like everyone is saying, it definitely fell in line with what was happening at the time. So going from scene to scene, yeah, it was great. Definitely.
Nice. I mean, so they're actually like pretty funny songs too. Like if you listen to the lyrics, like it's plausible that they would be like songs of that era, but at the same time, there's a level of self-awareness that isn't like, it's not getting to a point of parody, but it's kind of in this weird sort of middle zone. Like, I was just chuckling along with, you know, not just the way they're depicted in the movie, but even in the credits, I think they you get a sense of like how I would say just how well Billie Eilish and Finneas know that world that they're like, it's a kind of self-aware sort of, you know, gentle poking of the genre. But it also shows that they have a love for it. I think you need to have that love in order to kind of, you know, make fun of it, you know, have some fun with it a little bit.
Yeah. And I have to say, I love that the main, one of the songs is used, like, that's the moment when the friends really show May, no, we're here for you. Like, this is not, we're not scared. We're not, right. That's, and that's what I meant about the music. That's what I meant about the music being able to like tie it, being tied back into the themes of the movie as well.
Yeah. Well, and it also is just kind of like when you're 13, like you might like really junky stuff, but if you like it really sincerely and you bond over it with your friends, like that is, that makes it great, right? Like that shared enthusiasm over this thing that you both realize that you love. Cause like, you know, when you're a kid, it's a lot like you, a lot of times you just like stuff because it's in front of you, right? But then when you're like a teenager, you're making a choice and you're saying, I like this and I like this and I found other people who like this too. And that makes it really exciting. And so even if maybe like if you grow up and you're like, well, it was kind of a little bit embarrassing to like this thing. It's like, but you still like have such fondness for it because you were bonded over it with your friends. And I think that moment really captures that really well.
Well, that's much also much more meaningful than just being into something for a time because it was popular or you're trying to chase a fad, you know, like it's bonding on a genuine emotional level.
And the fact that it's not just the four friends, but also Tyler, who's been a thorn in the side of really all our characters, but especially Maylin Lee. I love that it's the five of them that you see in that shot. All of them have identical tears streaming down their faces, you know, losing their minds. And it's, but it's also this moment of like, you know, they've come together. There's this sense of unity among them in that moment, and it's a beautiful thing. And it feels very true because I feel like you could have had the Tyler character and made him just like a flat out villain. But I think we actually do get an understanding of like his insecurity and why he, you know, is a bully. And yet at the same time, he doesn't feel like he's demonized. He feels like a real person.
Yeah. The redemption of Tyler was something I really appreciated in this movie.
Yeah. It's a sneaky little, they just kind of backdoor that into the movie. You're like, oh wow, they're doing this.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're like, is that, you had to do a double take. Is that Tyler? Oh, it is. Yeah.
As did all the characters, I think. Yeah.
So. right.
And but what's nice about that moment is that like they're not like, oh my god, you like this? And like there's no, they're just like, you like this too? That's great. Now we can be friends. And it's just like there's such an enthusiasm there that is so open hearted. And I think that this film is really in a lot of ways about that kind of open heartedness at the end of the day.
I know I wanted to ask everybody what they thought of the way this film depicts romantic feeling, and especially around this age, because I think it does it in multifaceted ways here. When I mentioned earlier that there are some very relatable aspects, I think this particular aspect was the most relatable to me because it made me think back to that age and like what it meant, especially when you have like your first, maybe not for her, it seems to be like her first crush. I would say I remember being, I guess I would have been a little bit younger than she was at this time, but I remember like the first time I had a crush on someone, it felt like more than just kid stuff. It felt like, oh wait, I'm having these feelings for someone, like that's a thing, like I'm not a kid anymore. And I feel like this film did a good job of suggesting the level of denial that you have in that moment. And I think it's even more thorny for Maylin at this time because it's, you know, seems to be implied that for her to admit this like is not really safe within her family, or at least not accepted. And so there's that extra layer of danger and denial as a result because of it. But I wanted to ask like what you guys thought about all of that.
So you want me to go first as the lone girl here?
Please.
So definitely can relate to that, having crushes on boys that I would never admit to any family member, no matter how close I was. And there was a time in my life where one of my aunts, we're tight like glue and always have been because we're only 9 years apart. So we're like sisters, but, you know, we're aunt and niece. And I could always talk to her, and she would always ask me, do you like a boy? No, because I kind of felt like if she sees me as someone that likes the opposite sex, then what is she going to think that I'm doing? Like, I don't want them to think that I'm doing something that I have no business doing. And I think that's how May felt when her mom discovered, you like a boy? So I could totally relate to it. And then there would only be so much that I would divulge to my friends. So they knew that I liked someone, but it's just like, I'm teetering. Do I want to tell you? No, I kind of want to hold that close to my heart. So I could totally relate to it.
Yeah, I definitely feel that as well. And I think what's interesting about the way that it's presented here is that it doesn't, like, she doesn't really have, like, a romantic interest in anyone on screen, except for maybe the boy band people, which is definitely a celebrity crush is, like, a different type of crush.
Yeah,
right?
It's not, sure. That's but definitely not romantic. It's more,
but she's,
like
attracted to this kid, and she doesn't, and she can't quite make sense of it, because he's not the kind of kid who she's supposed to feel attracted to, right? Because he's, because he's like gross, right? She's telling all of her friends, like, oh, I can't believe you would even like that person. But then secretly she's drawing these pictures and like all this. And so she's like trying to like make sense of it in a way that felt really, really relatable. And then like for in that moment of sincere vulnerability where you don't even understand necessarily how you're feeling quite yet, for her mom to like walk in and see all of that stuff and jump to conclusions. Oh my God. I was so mortified for her. I felt so bad. When she was like, well, maybe I'll just move to another state and we won't have to see any of these people again. It's like, yeah, that's a good call. I would definitely do that.
It's brief detour into like horror territory in that sequence with that. Yeah. And I like the fact that we're left guessing what exactly she drew that scandal. She definitely didn't draw him as a merman. It's pretty clear the way her mother's like, huh? Huh?
At the same time, I could definitely see her mom twisting whatever she drew into something even more, you know, scandalous. So
that's true. But we don't know. We have to let our own dirty minds interpret that as we will. Yeah. But that whole, and that's what I meant with the animation style really popping. Her reactions, like May's face and the way the color shifts in moments like that, where it's just pure emotional terror. Like, again, this, and I harp on this all the time. That's the sort of stuff that really great animation can do that, of course, you know, in real life it would look silly if you were to do that sort of extreme reaction. But here you can just literalize how it feels in that moment. And just, you know, the sheer primal terror of, you know, this embarrassing thing happening, you know, and it's, you've not experienced, you've never experienced that before. Your brain doesn't know how to handle it. And you're just, you're grasping at straws. Yeah.
Although I don't think anybody's brain could handle that level of embarrassment.
That's true. I mean, as an adult, I have the means to move to another city if need be.
Yes, exactly.
As a kid, I don't have that ability.
But I did want to, like, before we end, and I know we're getting close to the end, I wanted to give a shout out to Orion Lee, who was great a couple years ago in First Cow, the Kelly Reichardt film, very different from this, although also features prominently an animal of a kind. but he plays the dad. He plays Jin, who's mm-hmm. May's dad. And I think that it's a very small role in this kind of mother-daughter conversation of a film. But he's just like a really nice supportive guy in the background the whole time. And he kind of picks his moment and it really makes a big impact. And I think that he does a really great job.
I appreciate that aspect of the film. Like, neither of the parents are dead, and neither of the parents are, like, wholly irredeemable or just pure stereotypes. Yeah, and I appreciate
everybody's
the fact
a person, which is nice. And he seems, yeah, and I would dad, really, his food looks delicious, and I really wish I could eat it.
Well, I my wife and I started howling when we don't even see him first. We just see him cooking. And it's like the intro. It's like the intro to it, like a cook-off show, the way it's framed. But I like the fact that they snuck in a really deep, just nice emotional scene with him and his daughter towards the end of the movie. It seems like he's just going to be like background wallpaper at first. Like, it takes a while before he even has a line of dialogue. He just makes noises like, whoa.
Right. Oh. Right.
And about half of the movie, I'm like, he speaks. But then he gets just a great and I think a very crucial moment where he just, he gives me this glimpse of like, no, your mother and I can also like support. We're not just here to humiliate and terrify you with how embarrassing we are. Like, we're here to support you as well.
Yeah, it is. I will say it is almost beat for beat the same role, like situation as Encanto. I don't know if everyone's seen Encanto yet, the Disney movie from the fall, but that also features a quiet, supportive father who, in the right moment, is emotionally supportive to their daughter. We're just like, oh, is this like the new formula for Disney movies? Where like you have this like complicated and rich female like matriarch, and then this like nice, quiet guy who's like behind the scenes, who's just like hanging out until he needs to like jump into action and be like, you're a good person, and then you know the movie ends.
I mean, but, the old formula is that one parent would be dead, so I'll take that trade off.
Yeah. It's true. One, if not both parents are usually dead in a Disney movie. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
But Lovie, what do you think about that, Lovie?
About the dad?
Yeah.
I thought he was a little passive. Like, just, I need for him to step up a little bit, speak your mind. It's just like, I get that there's usually a good cop, bad cop, but I appreciate the, like you said, the ending. Towards the end where, you know, he shares this moment with May, like, I'm here for you. I'm your ally. You know, we got your back. But I kind of wanted to see a little bit more from him. Because, again, when we saw the opening scene for him cooking, now, someone who cooks, you're thinking it's going to be a personality, a little bit more personality involved. But there wasn't. So I was a little underwhelmed in that part.
All of his personality goes into the flavor.
Into the food. Yeah.
Yep.
His personality is his spice rack.
Hey, I'm here for it. I'm here for a good dish, so if that's what it takes, then so be it.
Also, one last comment for me. That poor Sikh school guard who May's mother keeps just shinning and keeps getting kicked in the kneecap.
Just like, here's the guy just trying to do his job.
Yeah, being very nice about it, also.
He seems like a sweet dude.
Like, justice could probably press charges for guard. Assault.
But they're in Canada, so he's super nice. So.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's true. Justin, do you have any final thoughts on the movie?
Honestly, just, you know, I think I just was so happy to have, you know, any sort of wariness I had kind of melted away as I actually watched the movie. And... you know, there was some, I don't want to get into it because I almost don't want to dignify that one review, but that it has gone around on the internet. But basically the thrust of it was like, I don't know if I, like, this seems like it was very specific, made for a niche audience. And that was just not my experience at all watching this. And I think it also speaks to this, the other fundamental flaw I found in that was this idea that for something to be good or to be, like, it has to be an experience that you've also had, and I just don't understand that. Like, I've watched, there's so many movies I love
that's not
people
who
have very different
exists.
Experiences than me, and you know, it's about like a good movie should make you understand what they're going through so you can feel for them, and that's what this movie was able to do for me. So I don't know, that just that whole thing was confusing to me. I just the fact that the editor came out and said like this was not properly edited. As an editor, I'm thinking like my guess is it was not edited. But, yeah, you know,
it anyway. Should have been deleted. That should have been the editing that took place.
The critic also came out and apologized and said that like he should have thought more before writing that and been more considerate in his review. So
and there's as well. There's been some other culture clash nonsense thrown up about the movie. It's all in just terribly bad faith. So.
Yeah, I mean, I did see like some people being like, this Disney is producing a movie that teaches kids to disrespect their parents and ignore them. Oh, and it's like, what movie did you watch? That's not what this is about at all. Just like, that's a wild takeaway in my
that's
opinion.
That's one of those Twitter. Tell me you've not seen the movie without saying you've not seen it.
Yeah,
I guess we'll wrap it up there for now. This was so much fun.
Yeah,
I'm glad that we all really liked it. I mean, I honestly, it was like I said, it was such a balm after some more depressing things I've been seeing lately. So I'm really glad for that.
And if you've watched this and you've liked this, definitely watch the Making of special on Disney Plus. And also on Disney Plus is that first short that Dummy she did, which is just called Bow, which is just so excellent. I remember watching it ahead of Incredibles 2 and being like, well, I don't know how this movie is going to stand up to this, to the experience of watching this short, because I'm ready to like leave the theater now because that short was so fantastic. So yeah, definitely check that out as well.
Yeah, I had to rewatch it before I saw Turning Red because I had such fond memories of it, and I'm really glad I did. And some similar themes, so
definitely.
You know what? I had never known about it until one day I was on recording for my podcast and one of my friends mentioned it. And I was like, Bow, what? And they were like, yeah, she eats the dumpling. And I'm like,
it's like, a great advertisement for a film. She eats the dumpling.
Hey, she's like, she loves
coming to a theater near you.
Cares for it, and then she eats. I was like, oh no. So I had to go watch it. I was like, okay.
Yeah. It's a lot. Yeah. But I really liked it.
the hardest I laughed was, I think, when the soccer ball hits his head, and because he's a dumpling, it just like creates this compression in his head. Like, it's so great. Anyway. So let's talk about where we can find everybody online, and I will start with you, Lovey. Where's the best place to find your work?
YouTube. Well, of course, in addition to here on popbreak.com, but definitely on YouTube under Live, Laugh, and Lovey. And is A-N-D.
That's such a great title.
Thank you. My friend came up with that. Unfortunately, I wasn't that clever that day.
Well, it's very magnanimous of you to not take credit for it. Do you want to tell our audience a little bit about your show and what you guys talk about? You can also, by the way, subscribe to Pop Break TV on any podcasting platform to get it every Monday.
Yeah, so my friends and I, we recap television shows, which right now our most popular is Married at First Sight. And if you are not familiar with this show, it is exactly how it sounds. You are getting married at first sight. You do not know who you are marrying until you get down to the altar. Hi, my name is Lovey. And I do. And you go. And it is the greatest social experiment on the planet, where you are literally pulling your hair out because you want to yell at the TV screen, this is not how marriage goes. And so my friends and I, we all come together as a collective to pick it apart and yell at the screen. And yeah, it's great appointment TV.
And I feel like Live, Laugh, and Lovey is the after party for that show that everyone needs to listen to, because they really have a great time with it every week.
We do. We try to have fun.
Yeah, I was listening to a bit of, I think, your last episode, and I just love any time you would make someone make a remark about the shade being down. It was really funny.
Oh yeah, definitely. One of my friends, she has a fan, literally. And sometimes you can hear it waving. the shade definitely gets real.
Yeah.
Even if you don't watch Married at First Sight, the podcast is a lot of fun. Maybe even more fun because you have to decipher what actually was happening on the show that week based on what you guys are reacting to.
Yeah, it's funny. I tell everyone you have to watch it at least one episode because it's ridiculousness on a plate served to you hot and fresh.
Yeah, it's true. A few seasons ago there was like a person who just wouldn't stop farting, right? And that was like a whole storyline, was they were just like, they just wouldn't stop farting in front of their new spouse. To the point where like it seemed like they had a medical problem, like no one should fart that much. You just it's never riveting. Know what you're gonna get.
It's riveting TV.
That automatically sounds more dignified than like half of the stuff on American TV on your average day. So
yeah, it's really good. They have an Australian version as well. Theirs is a little bit different, but yeah, it's funny.
You're married to a stranger and the world around you is trying to kill you.
Yep. Just add one more thing on there. Great. How about you, Noah? Where can we find your work online?
Well, as Justin already mentioned, you all should also not just check out our work here in Cinema Joes, but the work that Justin and I do on Podwork Angels, our Rush podcast, and also our old podcast on the discography of Genesis, Pod on the Rooftops. And for me, you guys can also check out all of my written film reviews and other cultural musings at my blog at francenoir.blogspot.com.
For myself, you can find my work at thecinemaverick.com. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick. Podwork Angels, which Noah mentioned that the best place to find that is either on the Pop Break or part of the Breakcast feed as part of the Pop Break. We do that, of course, with Luke Martin, who does another podcast on thepopbreak.com called Talking the Coda. So we have a lot of fun doing that. Let's close with you, Alex. Where can we find your work?
So you can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. You can follow our show at Cinema Joes on Twitter and subscribe to all major podcast platforms that way. You can also follow my work over at The Pop Break, where I'm the podcast editor, as Justin said earlier. Best way to see all of my stuff over there is just go on to thepopbreak.com and click on the podcast tab, where you'll see all the podcasts that I'm supervising and some of the ones that I'm on right now, including TV Break, which is part of Pop Break TV's podcast feed, where we talk about one new release every month and talk about some news and some headlines. And this month, we're going to be talking all about how there is way, way, way too much new TV coming out in the next couple of months for reasons that boggle the mind. So we're going to get into all of that, as well as review Slow Horses, which is one of those new TV shows, a Gary Oldman spy TV show on Apple TV Plus. You can also subscribe to The Breakcast to find Bill versus the MCU, which is a show that I do with Bill Botkin, Pop Break editor-in-chief, where we go through all of the MCU, three or four movies at a time. Right now we are doing, we just did The Winter Soldier and Thor The Dark World and Iron Man 3. So that was a real roller coaster of emotions of an episode.
I assume at the end is going to end with Bill being the next villain for the next phase of the MCU, correct?
It very well could be. It's a year-long project that we've embarked on.
He created
on,
the so. Celestials.
But in addition to that, I actually just guested on Socially Distance podcast, their 100th episode, which was dedicated to Moneyball, of all things. And they had nine guests, and I was one of them. And
oh, you told me about
I got to talk all about the 2011 Oscar race and how Moneyball fit into that. So if you're curious about that, you can check out that at Socially Distanced on all major podcast platforms or on thepopbreak.com.
Awesome. Well, we thank you for that. And I know we want to thank all of our listeners and all of our subscribers for sticking with us, and we hope to bring you many more great episodes, many more great reviews in this year. But for now, this is Justin Mancini for the Cinema Joes signing off.